Welcome to the MedEvidence Podcast, hosted by Dr. Michael Corrin and Michelle McCormick. MedEvidence, where we help you navigate the real truth behind medical research with both a clinical and research perspective. In this podcast, we'll have discussions with physicians that have extensive experience in patient care and research. How do you know that something works? In medicine, we conduct clinical trials to see if things work. Now, let's get the truth behind the data.
Welcome to MedEvidence, powered by Encore Research Group. Go to EncoreDocs.com. This is MedEvidence, truth behind the data, with Dr. Michael Corrin. He is a practicing cardiologist and chief executive officer at Encore Research Group, which conducts trials across Florida, clinical trials across Florida. He has been the principal investigator of over 2,000 trials and has been published in the most prestigious medical journals. Dr. Corrin received his medical degree, cum laude, at Harvard Medical School. For more information on local trials, visit EncoreDocs.com. That's EncoreDocs.com or call 904-730-0166. Well, in this episode, MedEvidence, Truth Behind the Data with Dr. Michael Corrin, we're actually going to talk about truth behind the data. Well, Dr. Corrin, in the first segment, we talked about lady tasting tea, this experiment and why it's so important to what you're doing now with clinical trials. But you mentioned some statistical concepts.
Right.
Let's dive into those a little bit.
Just to remind people who missed the first segment, the lady tasting tea experiment was a member of the British royalty who claimed that she can tell if milk was put in first or tea was put in first when she had her, you know, her mid-afternoon tea. The Brits love their tea, as you know. And her claim to fame is that she can tell which one was put in first, whether or not she saw that happen. And she said it over and over again. A lot of people believed her. Some people were skeptical. And a very famous statistician named R.A. Fisher said, I can test this to see if she's telling the truth. And this is the basis, actually, of modern clinical trials, believe it or not.
Well, and I look forward to finding out the response to that.
So there are three very, very important elements of hypothesis testing in modern clinical trials. They have to be prospective, blinded, and randomized. So let's talk about what each one is.
Okay.
Prospective means you're putting the thing together before you have any information. So prospective means ahead of time. So in order for you to do a good research study and to run a clinical trial or to do a good hypothesis test, you need to set up all the rules for the test beforehand. It would be cheating if you said, okay, well, we're going to make a bunch of observations and then we'll kind of look at it later on.
Right.
And so a hard science and good hypothesis testing requires that you lay it all out. This is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to do it. And this is the number of observations that will be required to determine whether or not we can establish the truth.
Yeah. Sounds like a very fancy science fair project.
Exactly. Well, remind me to tell you about one of my kids' science fair projects.
Okay. I will.
Okay. So an event. Prospective is very, very important. Set up the experiment, planned experiment. We had other sessions where we talked about the very famous smallpox experiment back into 1721 at the Newgate Prison in the UK. And that was considered the world's first clinical trial because it was a planned experiment of vaccination. It was one of the first experiments that said that vaccination actually works in a clinical trial, rather than just based on general observations, which is inductive reasoning versus a clinical trial, which is deductive reasoning.
Okay.
We can talk more about that in a
second.
Okay, prospective, ahead of time, set up the, it has to be planned.
Yes.
Okay. Second, it has to be blinded. Okay. Why does it have to be blinded? People cheat.
Well, this reminds me of like the Pepsi versus Coke back in the day, where there was the blind taste, you know, either they had blindfolds on or they had like the barrier in front of them.
Right. So if you saw it was Pepsi or Coke and you said, which tastes better? Well, it's whatever you believe.
Right.
But if you don't know what it is, then it's more credible. It's blinded. So blinding is very, very important because, you know, we may think we're objective, but we all have biases, and biases are, you know, just absolutely impossible to overcome. So you have to do something very specific to overcome biases, and the most effective way is blinding. In science, in clinical trials, we call it double blinding. So in double blinding, we have the situation where both the people who are volunteering for the experiment and the experimenters both are unaware of which assignment they have.
Okay.
So that way there's no biases from either side and there's no biases between the interaction. So for example, if you're tasting Coke and Pepsi and you don't know what it is, you had the blindfold on, but I know what it is. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, I could do things that would bias you.
I was going to say, so, you could direct me. Right, what, so, are you sure you don't like this one better?
If you're, you know, a Coke salesperson, you could say, well, do you like that first one, that incredibly effervescent first one? Or do you like that kind of flat, the second one?
Right.
So unless both sides are blinded, there's inadvertent ways that you can influence people.
Yeah. Is that where a placebo would come in? That phase?
Placebo is another concept of it. We'll get to that in a second.
Okay.
Because a placebo is one form of control.
Gotcha.
And that's not one of the three things. You're going to the fourth concept.
Okay. I've jumped ahead.
Right. Okay. So, for example, in the lady tasting tea, what we're trying to figure out was the tea first or the milk first. Mm-hmm. So there's not a placebo in that. You're just trying to test whether or not somebody's telling the truth. So you don't need a placebo in hypothesis testing, but we often have that. So we'll get to that in a second.
All right.
Okay. And then the third thing is randomized.
Yes.
Okay. So randomized means that when you're doing your observations, when you're going through your experiment, there has to be a random order of things. Okay. So for example, in the lady tasting tea, if you didn't randomly mix up milk first or tea first, you can figure out a pattern. So let's say that you did five in a row that was all milk first. Mm. And then you switched it, and the next five is tea first. Well, the human brain may be able to perceive a slight difference. Okay, same, and then all of a sudden different. And so that may actually help the person along the way. So randomization makes it much more difficult for you to find a pattern, mm-hmm. number one. And it also sorts out differences that may occur by chance. So for example, let's say that you're testing a blood pressure drug and you know that the blood pressure drug should work better in people who are overweight. So if it wasn't a random assignment of patients, you could put all the overweight people in one arm and all the people that are close to normal weight in another arm, and that may influence the results. But if you have just a random number generator saying, okay, you're coming in, we don't know if you're overweight or not. Mm-hmm. You're going to be in this arm of the study, and you're going to be this arm of the study, this arm of the study, this arm of the study. Any of these possible differences will just sort themselves out by chance. And when the numbers get big enough, you're almost certain that they'll sort themselves out by chance.
Yeah.
So those are the three key elements of good hypothesis testing. And that's what R.A. Fisher was able to teach us and to use this incredible, powerful concept to establish the truth. Now you got to the fourth one, which is placebo controlled, or it's really just a control.
Control.
Mm-hmm. So when you say placebo, it means that the control is inactive. And obviously when we do medical drug testing or medical product evaluations, we often use a placebo. So for example, a new drug is coming on the market and we want to see whether or not it's effective. And the best way of doing that is to put it in a form where you can't really tell what it is, and compare it with something that's inactive, and then give one or the other in a prospective blinded randomized fashion to a group of patients and seeing whatever the outcome measurement is and see if it's different. Mm-hmm. So for example, if you were testing a blood pressure drug against placebo, you would have a pill or an injection that looks identical whether or not it's active or not, and then you would give it to a bunch of people, and then you measure their blood pressure. And if it's an effective treatment, the people who have the active product would have lower blood pressures mm-hmm. at some period of time after the intervention than the people that were on the placebo. But there are other forms of control. So a controlled experiment doesn't mean necessarily a placebo. Mm-hmm. So for example, if you want to show that drug A is better than drug B, but you're really testing drug A, that's your primary hypothesis, then drug B is called a control substance. And that's the comparator. Now, we often do that when there's a standard of care. So, for example, in a lot of blood pressure studies, you wouldn't want to not treat patients for an extended period of time. It would be considered unethical because we know blood pressure lowering saves lives, prevents strokes, and does other things that are positive for the human body. So you may get away with a short-term where you're comparing a drug versus placebo. Mm-hmm. But certainly it would be unethical to do that over any extended period of time, you know, a week or two, whatever that may be. So in that case, you need to use some sort of control agent so that at least everybody is getting something. And then you're seeing whether or not the new agent is an incremental improvement compared to the control agent.
Okay.
So that is a very, very key part of what we do in drug development virtually every day.
Yeah. So when did, you know, what's the history of clinical trials? When did they first begin?
So, you know, it's interesting. So there's a lot of debate about that. So getting into the faith thing, yeah, there are things in the Bible where there was choices that people had to make. And there's a passage about Daniel in the Bible and the Babylonians. And so we sometimes talk about that as the first experiment. It's not really a clinical trial because it wasn't, it didn't have all those elements. It had to be prospective, blind, and randomized.
right, which grew over time, I'm guessing.
right. But basically, Daniel said that, well, if the Babylonians eat their rich foods and I eat, you know, basic, you know, bread and water and healthy foods, then I'm going to be stronger than you.
Oh.
And after 10 days, that turned out to be true. So again, this was his hypothesis. He chose one diet and there was a control. And he, you know, based on the outcome measure that he picked, he did better. So that's an example. But we don't really consider that a modern clinical trial.
right. And you said the smallpox. Was that the first modern medical trial?
Yeah, so the first modern clinical trial. And even that's not perfect by any means. But back in 1721, there was this theory based on observations from Africa and the Middle East, is that if you had smallpox, you can protect yourself from severe complications of smallpox by purposefully infecting yourself in the leg or in other parts of the body. And it was based on an observation that people who, just to get everybody up to speed, smallpox was absolutely devastating for hundreds and hundreds of years. And the mortality rates during smallpox pandemics were 33%, about a third of people in a community would die of this infection. Crazy, crazy, horrible things. So obviously people were scared to death when they were learning that there was a smallpox pandemic coming their way. And what people also observed is that for the survivors of a smallpox pandemic, they were much less likely to get sick during the next pandemic or the next epidemic. And so they said, well, why is this? And ultimately they figured out that if you expose yourself to this virus in a certain way, you can protect yourself. So if you get smallpox through the respiratory means and you're not protected, you're going to get really, really sick and maybe die. Mm-hmm. But if you got injected with smallpox, they found that you had a small local infection, but you seemed to protect yourselves. And this was actually an empiric observation in the Middle East and in Africa. And during the pandemic of 1721, the British royalty was so worried about this that they took these crazy ideas from the Middle East and they said, let's try it. So the researchers went to a prison, because at that point it was considered ethical to take prisoners, and they told the prisoners, okay, if you want to get out of jail, then you be part of this study. And we set it up. We got consent for the study. Consent is an important part of clinical trials that we actually practice every day. But in that case, it wasn't the consent of the patients, it was the consent of the king.
Oh, okay.
But it was prospective, it was consent-based, and it was an organized trial where they took six people and they gave them these, they actually did surgery, cut their legs, put smallpox pus in those wounds, made sure that they had an infection, and then they saw how those people compared to the general prison population in terms of whether or not they contracted smallpox or died from it.
Huh.
And all six of the people in that experiment seemed to be immune to the effects of smallpox. And there's some interesting nuances that we can get into the next segment, but it was considered the first clinical trial because, again, they looked at a group, it was a prospective experiment, and they had a comparative group as the rest of the people in the prison.
I'm your host, Michelle McCormick, and we want to thank Dr. Michael Corin for his clinical and research perspective behind the science in this episode of MedEvidence, the truth behind the data.